So I'm the moderator, and we have four presenters today. And the first of our speakers today is Tarika Barnum. And Tarika just finished her MPH at the Rowland School of Public Health at Emory University in behavioral science in 2009. And she worked on several research projects at Emory, including Project RISE, the Partner Incarceration and Women's Health Project, where she was project coordinator for 2009. And that's what this presentation is about, from 2009 to 2011. She is currently a contractor for ICF International and works as a public health analyst for the Prevention Research Branch at CDC's Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention. So welcome, Tarika. It's all yours.
Can everyone hear me? Okay. My name is Tarika Barnum, actually. It's okay. And I'm here to present on the effects of long-term partner incarceration on sexual relationships of drug-using African-American women. And before I begin, myself and Kelly and I, we are on the same project. We'll be presenting for the same project, and I'm going to give most of the background as well as the methods and just give more information about my analysis topic, and then Kelly will finish with her analysis topic and then go forward with the conclusion and the limitations. So just to begin, the United States is currently in an era of mass incarceration, as 3.1% of the total adult population is incarcerated. African American men are disproportionately likely to be incarcerated, as African American men were more than six times, the incarceration rates for African American men were more than six times higher than white men in 2009, and 39% of the incarcerated males were African American. When males leave to go to prison, or when they are incarcerated, they usually leave a female partner behind to take care of the household. They have to take care of household responsibilities, paying rent. They also have to take care of the children, as well as other basic needs. And Kelly will go more into detail about how that changing, the household changes once a partner leaves to go into prison. For drug-using African-American women, however, partner incarceration is relatively common. The reason why is because drug-using women tend to form relationships with drug-using men, and drug-using men, especially drug-using African-American men, are at high risk of incarceration due to trends in sentencing as well as drug-related enforcement. Then losing a partner to prison can alter women's drug-using behaviors. Only two studies have explored this topic, in which they found that women usually hit rock bottom after their partner leaves prison, and they increase their drug use to cope with the stress of losing a partner to prison, as well as the changes in their economic situation. And some women actually see prison, their partner's prison entry, as an opportunity to enter drug treatment. They may, while their partner was with them in the community, they may not have been strong enough to stop their own use of drugs, and while their partner is in, they may take the opportunity to go seek drug treatment on their own. Drug-using African-American women have an exceptionally high prevalence of sexually transmitted HIV infection, and just general African-American, in general, African-American women accounted for 57% of new HIV infections in 2009, and 85% of these women acquire HIV via through sex with a male partner. And drug-using women may feel pressured to access drugs and engage in unprotected sex, tolerate partners that have other partners, or rely on sex work in order to access drugs. While research has been conducted on partner incarceration and African-American women's vulnerability to sexually transmitted HIV, these studies have yet to include drug-using African-American women. And so the overall purpose of Project RISE was to explore the processes through which incarceration of a primary male partner shapes women's emotional status, their depression, if they become lonely, their economic status, changes in finances or housing, drug use, social status like experiences with stigma, as well as their children's welfare and just general parenting. The purpose of this analysis will to explore the effects of long-term incarceration of a male sexual partner on drug-using African-American women's sexual relationships. And the overall criteria, women had to be African American, they had to live in the metro Atlanta area, they had to self-report HIV negative status, and they had to have a primary male partner who had been recently incarcerated, and based on charges or sentencing, would remain in prison or jail for at least 6 months or longer. Most of the men in that, so for example, Fulton County Jail in Atlanta, Georgia, they were held in jail for a year without being sentenced or are still awaiting trial. And based on their charges, we wanted to make sure that they would still remain in prison for a long time. The study was conducted where women participated in four waves of one-on-one semi-structured interviews over a year to explore changes over time. So that's why we wanted to make sure that our partners would remain in jail for a long period of time. Participants were recruited through multiple venues that women would more than likely have an incarcerated partner. So we recruited at prisons and jails, drug treatment centers and shelters, as well as women were referred to us through word of mouth. Quota sampling was used to create a sample of drug-using and non-drug-using women, and this analysis will only use drug-using women, and we collected for 15 drug-using women. Data covering domains related to drug use, sexual behaviors, romantic relationships were analyzed using grounded theory methods, and the results are preliminary, as Wave 1 data was the only one used, were the only results used for this analysis. And preliminary analysis suggests that partner incarceration influences women's drug use and sexual behaviors. We found that their economic and housing situation before their partners entered jail actually had an effect on their drug use and sexual behaviors. And I'll start by going into their economic and housing status before their partners entered prison. Their housing status was generally secure, meaning that they were not worried about losing their home. They were able to pay rent. And the reason why was because their partners actually contributed to the household economy. The partner either directly paid the rent or contributed to the rent or even provided food stamps, offered instrumental support like child care, car repairs, and this is a quote from one of our participants. He would, just be a man and step up to the plate and pay the bills. That's what I liked about him most, because he wanted to keep a roof and light and gas and food in the home. And drug use prior to the partner's incarceration ranged from cocaine abuse to alcohol dependence, to frequent alcohol binging, to marijuana use several times a day or a week. And most of the women use with their partner either alone, one-on-one, or at social events. And some women actually concealed the extent of their alcohol or drug abuse from their partner by hiding how much they used it or the kind of drug that they used. For example, a participant stated that she hid her use because she didn't want him to look at her as a crackhead. She didn't want that stigma that she would be labeled as a crackhead by her partner. And she says that he has never even seen me use, so it's still probably a question in his mind whether I do crack or not. He's never seen me use. After the partner enters prison or jail, their housing status generally changes. They become precariously housed, even meaning that they stay with friends or family members, or they become literally homeless, meaning that they're either in a shelter or living in streets. Most of the time, drug-using women were more isolated prior to incarceration because of their drug dependence, and they didn't really have any friends or family. So by the time that their partners entered prison, they were very isolated and had less support than the non-drug-using women, or rather the women who were less dependent on drugs. Women, after entry to prison or jail, they sought institutional support, such as aid from shelters, aid from community-based organizations, aid from governmental organizations. And this was enough to keep the women out of the shelters, but it wasn't enough to keep them out of the shelters, but it was sufficient enough to keep them off the street, and it could help them to transition to a secure home. Incarceration created a lot of financial burden for women. They had to put money on the phone in order to communicate with their partners, or put money on his books so that he can purchase stamps in order for them to communicate with the female partner on the outside. They had to travel to visits that cost transportation, as well as other needs to get to travel to visit their partner in prison. They also had to purchase stamps, like I said earlier, as well as cover legal fees, paying for the lawyer and whatnot. And most of the time, their economic situation was often worse before their partners entered jail, which left very little financial cushion to cover the added-on expenses. Participants say, I really haven't as she means she hasn't been able to support her partner's legal fees because she couldn't financially take care of him because she could barely live on herself. She can barely take care of her own self. After the partner enters jail or prison, almost all of the women actually reported a decline in alcohol or drug abuse or completely stopped use. This was related to their economic status, as the women just couldn't simply afford to pay for the same amount of drugs that they used before incarceration, and they couldn't pay enough to sustain their use. This also brought several women to seek drug treatment to get their lives back on track. After the partner was incarcerated, they realized that their lives might need to change to, you know, this is an opportunity for them to improve their lives for the better. And women would enter drug treatment. They felt their life was off track before a partner entered prison, or the partner was the reason for the life getting off track in the first place. And some women actually continued to use because of the emotional and economic stress. Drug use helped the women to cope with the loneliness and the sadness from losing a partner. And women used to cope with the economic disruption and used drugs to cope with the economic disruption and increased incarceration expenses. Participants say lately it's been a lot more recently as far as her use of marijuana, especially about me not having no job. I really have been not trying to smoke, but sometimes it just gets the best of me, and I do smoke, so I have started smoking a lot more than I used to, just meaning that she's just started using more to cope with the loss of a partner as well as the loss of her job. Now, generally, women remain sexually abstinent at wave one. I want to emphasize at wave one, and Kelly will go into that in more detail later on. But women who remain with their partners were not allowed to have physical sex with their partners. Conjugal visits aren't allowed in Georgia, and also if the woman was to visit their partner in prison or jail, the actual setting of the visitation room prohibited them from being able to physically touch. They either had to communicate with the partner over the phone, or if they were able to see their partner face-to-face, they could either hug or maybe a kiss right before or upon arrival, the partner coming to see them, and then right again after their partner was about to leave. So to maintain some level of physical intimacy, most women will engage in phone sex with their partner. And women who abuse drugs, however, they develop non-sexual relationships with male friends outside of the relationships with their partner. They generally use these male friends, quote-unquote, for financial support. They kind of instilled a sense of trust with these male partners to get them to give them money, and they will use that money to either put on their phone or put on the partner's books or even buy drugs themselves. And most of the time, women didn't tell their incarcerated partners about the male friend, one, because their partners would get mad at them and probably make them in the relationship with the male friend, but they were clear to the male friend that they were in a separate category than an incarcerated partner, stating that you are only my secondary partner and my main partner. When he gets out, I will probably be with him again. And women who sought treatment, they didn't form new relationships most of the time because treatment programs typically discourage participants from forming new romantic or sexual relationships for some time after they enter treatment. And some women were in residential programs, which prevented the opportunity to form relationships with men. Women who were drug dependent, however, and not in drug treatment, were at risk for sexually transmitted HIV. They were more likely to engage in new sexual relationships in order to access drugs or just to obtain basic needs like rent or food. And most women would exchange sex for drugs, housing, or money in the days and weeks following the partner's incarceration. So in conclusion, incarceration does create an economic and housing changes, which affects drug use. A lack of financial support from the partner and increased incarceration expenses leads to change in housing status and the woman's reliance on family, friends, or institutions, like I said earlier, about such as church or community-based organizations. And women will either reduce or stop their drug use. They sought treatment after the partner entered prison or jail, or they continue to use as a coping strategy. And the risk of sexually transmitted HIV in this population was relatively low, as drug-using women were not starting new sexual partnerships unless they were drug-dependent and not in treatment. And Kelly will go into this in more detail, but again, this is just wave one preliminary data. The relationships could have changed over time as the women did go into more interviews, three other interviews, and they might have relapsed or they might have developed new sexual relationships. If further analysis supports these preliminary findings, then the post-incarceration period is an important time for women to have access to drug treatment and interventions that reduce the harms of drug use and sexual partnerships. And future research should explore changes in drug use and development of new sexual relationships over time. Now it's time for Kelly.
Thank you.
I fell asleep, right?
Thank you. Ms. Barnum. And now we have Ms. King, Kelly King, and she is also a graduate student at Emory in the public health school. And she graduated. She graduated with her MPH in behavioral science in health education at Emory School this year in 2011. She is currently a first-year PhD student at the University of Chicago in their School of Social Service Administration. Her primary research interest is HIV prevention in low-income African-American communities, with a special focus on the role of that relational gender and power dynamics, community violence, and incarceration play in the spread of the disease. And thank you, Ms. Kelly. And we look forward to your presentation.
Great, thank you. Hopefully you guys can see me over the podium. All right, so my presentation today is entitled Stand By My Man, Better Understanding African-American Women's Motivations for Maintaining Relationships with Incarcerated Partners. So as Tarika mentioned, she presented the background for our overall project and some of the background information about incarceration rates. And I'm just going to add a little bit more background specific to my research question, and hopefully you guys can draw these two presentations together and see how they connect, and I'll end with some overarching discussion for both projects. So research has been done that demonstrated that women who maintain monogamous partnerships with inmates during their incarceration may be at increased rate of HIV. So this was research that was done by Comfort and Grinstead, and they found that there were two main pathways by which HIV risk increased. Both of them had to do with sex during incarceration, the first being that during conjugal visits, women were less likely to use condoms with their partners because they perceived these as interfering with longed-for intimacy. Additionally, there was a lack of condom use when women were engaging in sex that wasn't supposed to occur during visitation, that would be kind of clandestine and sneaked, and that reduced, so kind of the secretive nature of these encounters and prison policies restricting the use of, or the condoms being brought into the prisons, led to decreased use. So this study was done in California, where conjugal visits are legal. Most states don't allow conjugal visits, even if partners are married. So very little research has actually been done in states that do not allow conjugal visits. There is also some previous research that it suggests that incarceration may serve as a risk factor even when there isn't that opportunity for sexual contact while the partner is incarcerated. Here, women reported misperceptions of jail as a protective environment. So they believed that there were policies that had all inmates tested upon entering the facility and believed that their partner would communicate a positive HIV status to them. Additionally, they thought that since their partner was incarcerated and not having contact with other women, that they would be protected from increased risk. However, as we know, there's opportunities for non-consensual sex and drug use and things like that inside prison that actually do serve to increase risks of HIV. Additionally, incarceration can be both a financially devastating and emotionally very difficult time for women who lose their partners. In terms of finances, research has shown that family income drops significantly after an incarceration event. It's especially difficult on mothers who need to incur additional costs of raising a family and have lost the support of their partner. And also, as Tarika mentioned, there's just a huge financial cost associated with actually maintaining contact with the inmate. Women have reported putting lots of money on phones, paying for lawyer fees, et cetera. In addition, incarceration can also erode the women's emotional well-being. Previous research suggests that disrupting the shared life that the women had with their partner can lead to loneliness or anxiety about their children and their lives without their father or their partner, and just anxiety about their partner and his well-being while he is incarcerated. So the rationale for my specific analysis was that we have information that establishes relationships between financial difficulties, emotional difficulties, and increased HIV risk among women who decide to remain with their partners, but we don't really have a good sense of why women do remain in these relationships. So this analysis seeks to understand what influences women to remain in often emotionally and financially difficult relationships. And here we're particularly interested in alcohol and drug abusing women. As Terica mentioned, they're at increased risk of losing their partner and may be at even higher risk of HIV. So my methods are the same as Terica's methods. However, for my specific analysis, instead of focusing only on drug-using women, I looked at all participants who completed the Wave 1 interviews, so that was 32 women, and then data covering domains that were related to relationship quality, both pre- and post-incarceration, emotional well-being, and future expectations for the relationship were analyzed using grounded theory methods. And again, I just want to point out that these results are preliminary and based only on our Wave 1 interviews. All right, so these preliminary analyses identified several reasons that women do remain in romantic relationships with their partners after they're incarcerated. The first dimension had to do with the quality of the relationship before the incarceration event. So here, women who were emotionally really connected to their partners or had integrated their lives with them or with their families before he was incarcerated more often chose to remain in that partnership. So here, life integration can be integrated by living together, having children together, or in the cases when there wasn't a family or a shared household, having integrated relationships with each other's friends and family. For drug use women specifically, it's really important to note that often their families didn't approve of the relationship. They felt that their partner was a bad influence, so families would be disapproving of the relationship. However, instead of leading to the dissolution of the relationship, often women took on an us-against-the-world quality, and it actually bonded them closer with their male partners. It's also important to note here that when relationships did end, it was often women who had experienced violence at the hand of their partner used the incarceration event as a time to end that relationship. So this is a quote just representing this first dimension of relationship closeness. This woman shared, you know, "I trust him and I do love him, so I won't just walk away. There's a lot of qualities about him that I've seen and I've liked and come to respect. So as opposed to other men that I've seen, dated, even been married to, that I saw in him, and even with him establishing a relationship with my children, I'm willing to wait. You know, I'm willing to wait through this incarceration event," because she loves her partner. Another main theme that came up was the desire to keep the family together. So a lot of the women in our sample had children with their partners. Oftentimes these were very young children, and they'd formed a family unit. Often women shared co-parenting responsibilities, and even when this co-parenting was flawed and women felt like their partner wasn't pulling his fair share of the weight, the partner's involvement in caretaking was critical to the children's lives, and overwhelmingly, children reported loving their fathers, having good relationships with them, and this served as a motivation to want to remain in relationships. Another theme that emerged was this issue of personal strength. So women who stayed with their partners put forth a tremendous amount of effort to take care of them as best they could from afar. So this included sustaining an emotional connection with a future orientation. It also was best kind of demonstrated tangibly through financial support, putting money on their partner's books, contributing money to legal fees, bail, and just making personal sacrifices in their lives in order to put money on their phones and help their partners out. And a lot of times this was reiterated as a sense of obligation that the women would be there for their partners emotionally and financially during this time of need. And these emotional and financial sacrifices really contributed to how women viewed themselves in the world. And here's a quote representing that. So this woman shared, "You know, me being the woman that I am, I've always been a person that my word is my bond. If I say I'm going to do it, I'm going to get it done. I've got this covered here. I'm going to make sure you're covered too." Here she's talking about her partner. "And he doesn't like that because he knows I'm stretching myself, and he doesn't like it when I do that. The biggest problem right now is financial. Just trying to make sure he's taken care of and the house is taken care of, and not having no job, that's just the biggest thing." So just putting forth a tremendous amount of effort to demonstrate to her partner that she's supporting him. There were also external motivations for remaining in the relationship that emerged through this preliminary analysis. So in many cases, women's families and friends, and often their partners' families, encouraged women to stay with their partners through this difficult time. This encouragement was particularly strong when women were more integrated into the family and circles of friends of their partners and vice versa. And often the people who encouraged them to remain in the relationships would offer emotional support, occasionally financial support, and then instrumental support in terms of giving the woman a ride to the facility and things like that. A quote demonstrating this external encouragement is, one woman said, you know, I had to be strong, you know, because Tony, he's a strong person. And like his dad told me, he doesn't want nobody weak. Like, that's why one of the reasons he broke up with his first baby mama, because he felt she wasn't the strong woman he needed. So they were just telling me, if you want to be with him, just be strong, you know, so y'all can continue with y'all's relationship. So here it's clear that an external force, in this case her partner's father, is really encouraging her to be strong and stand by Tony. Other external motivations for remaining in the relationship are the existence of a prevailing cultural norm in the community about women's obligation to their partners during this incarceration. So this needs further explanation, but it might be that there are social forces that are encouraging women to be the type of women who would stay. Additionally, there is a structural reality of the incarceration event which forces women to choose between no contact and full-out commitment to their relationship. So given the difficulties that exist among maintaining contact with a partner, it's not like they could just be friends or see their partner occasionally like they might be able to in the community. Here, it's kind of all or nothing. And so it may implicitly pressure women to remain in relationships rather than choosing to lose their partner completely. And just a quote representing this was one woman shared. She said, just to get at them, here meaning her partner's family, I love him, though I'm not going to leave him just to make them mad. Even if I found me somebody, I'm not going to leave him just to make them mad, just because they felt like I wasn't going to be here when he went to jail and all that stuff. And I told them I love him, even though we don't have any kids together. So here this woman is saying, you know, like, my motivation is staying with him because I really want to prove his family wrong. Like, I am going to stay here and stand by him. So I just want to speak briefly about some overall limitations to the study and also to my research questions specifically. So this is a qualitative study. It has a relatively small sample. There were only 15 drug-using women and 17 non-drug-using women. So although there's great validity in hearing these women's stories, the results are not necessarily generalizable to a larger population. Additionally, the inclusion criteria for the study required that a woman have a primary partner who is incarcerated. So the women who chose to participate may have had fundamentally different relationships with their partners than the women who chose not to participate in this study. Additionally, it's going to be different than if we randomly sampled women who had lost partners to incarceration, because it doesn't capture women who immediately decided to end that relationship. And then I just want to reiterate that these are only wave one interviews, and these are relationships that really need to be further evaluated over time. And it's exciting that we have the data to do that. So in terms of my discussion, if further analysis supports these preliminary findings, it suggests that there are social, familial, and structural factors that may compel or support women to remain in relationships with incarcerated partners. And these factors may restrict women's ability to form new relationships or result in guilt and shame over decisions to end existing relationships. So further research is really necessary to explore how these social norms influence women's choices and impact HIV risk and their mental health outcomes. And then kind of tying together our two pieces. At the end of our analyses, the majority of women still considered themselves to be in committed relationships with their partner. And obviously there are a variety of reasons that women decided to stay in these partnerships. And further analysis is necessary to see how these are parsed out over time. Overall, it was a really financially and emotionally difficult and turbulent time for these women, both drug-using and non-drug-using. Drug-using women specifically did not start up new sexual partnerships unless they were drug-dependent and not receiving any form of drug treatment. So taken together, these findings suggest that new partnerships may be particularly important for both drug-using and non-drug-using women. And just to give you a little sneak preview, our preliminary impressions of Wave 2 interviews suggest that women are taking on new sexual partnerships as time goes on, in addition to remaining in their relationships with their incarcerated partner. So this increased partner concurrency may have implications for HIV risk, and we're going to be evaluating that in the future. I would just like to thank the women who participated in our study for so generously sharing their experiences with us and letting us into their lives, and also just acknowledge our funders for this grant. Thank you.